Well, the dendrites will grow a millimeter a day, but the axons will grow a millimeter a day. So if you sever a nerve, as it starts to regenerate, it has to regenerate from the nerve cell all the way back to the receptor, whether it's light touch or vibration. And so if you damage the nerve at the elbow for the hand, so the radial nerve, it's going to take however long that is in millimeters for it to regenerate.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Now, depending on the damage to the axon, will determine the likelihood of that full regeneration.
And, gentlemen, I want to emphasize that as the evolutionists have properly informed us, this is all by chance.
Yeah. Hoo-ah! Okay. Let the words of our mouth and meditations of our heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord. So I had in mind to review everything we talked about yesterday, but I decided not to, and just kind of pick up where we left off. And so I want to finish talking about the renewed mind, and we'll go over some of the emotional elements. We'll look at some studies relative to behavior science and conditioning, and then a little bit about, again, how to habit formations and those timetables. And then we'll talk a little bit about the five-day switch on your brain process again. I'll share a little one of my drawings with you from my time using this. And so then we'll move on to talk about the directed mind, and we'll base that off of Proverbs 16:9. Mark, I really appreciate your testimonial, and Ed, what you had to say. You're going to be a little surprised how that ties into what I'm going to talk about. But testimonial is really cool. It reminds me of down here at Decker's when Miss Fields was looking for a new stock boy. She put out an ad, and one of these mountain guys shows up, and he's 18, 19, looking for a job, his first job off the farm, off the ranch. And she said, "Well, I'd like to hire you, but you know, are you strong enough? It's a pretty strenuous job." And guy says, "Well, I think so." And so he kind of rolls up his sleeve and he flexes for her, and Miss Fields really liked that. She says, "Well, you know, you have to be able to lift these big boxes up there on that shelf. Do you think your back's strong enough to do that?" So he took off his shirt and turned around. He flexed for Miss Fields. She really liked that. She said, "Well, there's just one last thing. I need to check your testimonials." He didn't get the job. I hope that wasn't inappropriate. Okay, good. So one of the things we were left with was that attitude is composed of memory and emotion, and that when we have a memory, there's always a connection with emotion. We talked about that numbers can also connect in and have an emotional response. So you have a memory of a number. And so 9/11, you have certain emotions that come with that. 10/8. 10/8 is Jim's daughter's birthday and my daughter's birthday. And so you talk about 10/8. Yeah, there's some emotional connection to that. And so recognizing that those go together gives you a second handle to effective memory. And so what we're looking at is, what is this attitude, this memory and emotion? And Peter says, "Have this attitude in yourselves, which is also in Christ Jesus." And so we are to, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself, taking on the form of man. And being made in the likeness of man, he humbled himself by obedient to the point of death, even death on the cross. So that's the attitude of Christ. And we could dissect that if we wanted to, but the idea is I want to tie in with that completeness of what Christ's attitude was. We're also destroying every speculation in 2 Corinthians 5:10 and every lofty thing against the knowledge of God, and we're taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. So where does that emotional element lie? We talked about the cerebral cortex, finishing our neuroscience part of what we're examining. Those memories are stored in the cerebral cortex. Remember the 100 billion connections. But all of them get there through this limbic system. And the limbic system is composed of four major parts. The thalamus, which is the main relay. So all that sensory information that comes up, it all goes into the thalamus except for the olfactory, the smell. Don't know why, just doesn't. And then the other parts are the amygdala, the hippocampus, and the hypothalamus. So the hypothalamus is involved in long-term memory. The hippocampus and the amygdala connect up with the emotion, particularly the amygdala. So as the thalamus functions as this relay, it pulls in a portion and establishes a memory emotionally also within the amygdala. So emotions are funny things, and sometimes as guys we like to say, you know, I don't have any emotion. There are different levels of emotion that we all have. Some are very emotional. Some are not very emotional and react to things. We just have different distributions of that, just like every other thing in our life, whether it's strength or speed or knowledge. So how does that emotion play into our life? And Disney did this wonderful movie called Inside Out. How many of you have seen it before? Good. All right. So Disney, you know, that humanistic organization that creates movies that our kids love, and then we have to buy all the paraphernalia of Frozen dolls and Olaf and the princess dresses. So nevertheless, I think in this movie they had some psychologists helping with their writers. And so there are five emotions, and these five emotions control this 11 or 12-year-old girl as she and her family move to a new city and she has to go to a new school. So in each person, the movie shows these five emotions interacting to control the actions of the person. And there's more to those decision makings in a person. They don't show, and Disney doesn't show any moral conscience or really this center for decisions and who's running it. They just has the five emotions. They do a lot of things that are fun to see. If you watch the whole movie, they have long-term memory storage. They have key memory storages. And also they have the short-term, long-term connections. And then they have this thing called the train of thought. And they portray it as an amusement park train. So it's kind of fun to see. But I want to show you this little clip because there are five emotions. Sadness is there. You'll see from your left to right. So it's sadness, fear, joy, disgust, and then my favorite, anger. Amen. All right. So let me see if I can do this. I think I have to exit out, go here, and then go big, and then go play. And I think we're hooked
new
into
friends,
the sound.
Huh? I know. I'm kind of nervous, but I'm mostly excited. How do I look?
Very cute.
You're gonna be okay? You want us to walk with you?
Mom and Dad, with us in public? No, thank you.
Yeah, I'm on it.
Nope, I'm fine. Bye, Mom. Bye, Dad.
Have a good day at school, monkey.
Have a great day, sweetheart.
Are you sure we want to do this?
In we go!
Okay, going in!
Did you see
Okay, we got a group of cool girls at 2 o'clock.
How do you know?
Double ears pierced, infinity scarf.
Whoa, is she wearing eyeshadow?
Yeah, we want to be friends with them.
Let's go talk to them.
Are you kidding? We're not talking to them. We want them to like us.
Oh, yeah.
Wait, what?
Almost finished with the potential disasters. Worst scenario is either quicksand, spontaneous combustion, or getting called on by the teacher. So as long as none of those happen...
Okay, everybody. We have a new student in class today.
Are you kidding me? Out of the gates? This is not happening!
Riley? Would you like to tell us something about yourself?
No! Pretend we can't speak English!
Don't worry, I got this.
Okay. My name is Riley Anderson. I'm from Minnesota, and now I live here.
And how about Minnesota? Can you tell us something about it? Well, you certainly get a lot more snow than we do.
She's hilarious.
Yeah, it gets pretty cold. The lake freezes over, and that's when we play hockey. I'm on a great team. We're called the Prairie Dogs. My friend Meg plays forward, and my dad's a coach. Pretty much everyone in my family skates. It's kind of a family tradition. We go out on the lake almost every weekend. Or we did, till I moved away.
Hey, what gives?
What?
Hey, Sadness, you touched a memory? We talked about this.
Oh, yeah, I know. I'm sorry.
Get back in your circle. What's going on?
Get out of there, Joy!
We used to play tag and stuff.
Cool kids must prank at 3 o'clock.
No. Did you see that? Look! They're judging us!
Somebody help me! Grab that!
But everything's different now. Since we moved.
Oh, no. We're crying at school!
What? Sadness, what are you doing?
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's a core memory.
But it's blue. No, wait! Sadness! No! No!
Joy, no! That's a core memory!
Got it! Let's
wait!
Go.
Core memories!
Thank you, Riley. I know it can be tough moving to a new place, but we are happy to have you here. All right, everyone, get out your history books and turn to chapter 7.
Searching for the perfect family ski...
Oh, sorry. I have an ad. Have to pay the bills. It's blocking me. This and then go here and back to there. Oh, now I have to flip through everything. Sorry. This will be our review, huh? So what's interesting? So what was happening there? A core memory was being formed by the significance of that event, is what they're portraying, and in that case. You saw all the core memories were kind of yellow, so they were joyous memories, and now sadness was affecting this new memory. And so joy was trying to control the sadness memory, and then they both get sucked up with all the core, other five core memories out to this place where memories get destroyed. So their thing is that they've got to save Riley's mind, basically. So it's an interesting concept of how emotions interact and they play. So we want to be able to remember that we're going to use some emotions to trigger, and we can use our mind then to affect those emotions as well. But everybody's different in their emotional makeup, so I don't want to go too far into that. I want you to remember, though, this slide, which we had before, as it affects of where neuroplasticity takes place that's going to affect the genetic makeup. So that's how we're going to get axon regeneration, and that's how we're going to get other second messengers connecting to other dendrites affecting our neural connections. I want to talk a little bit about classical conditioning. So this is Ivan Pavlov. I didn't get into this before, did I? Okay. So Pavlov was a Russian neurologist right around the turn of the century. He was actually opposed to Stalin, although the Russians promoted him as a great, one of their great products of the revolution. He did win the Nobel Prize in medicine, but he's the one who developed this description of classical conditioning, the idea that you ring the bell and the dog salivates, right? Because you've connected the food with the ringing of the bell. A paper by Littman, she actually questions whether there was really a bell used, and it's still obscure. But nevertheless, that's how the story goes. But what he described was this an unconditioned response. So an unconditioned response is where technology. The unconditioned response is something that occurs as a reaction to something that doesn't have to be learned. So in the mouse, when you shock them, they have, it's called a fear response. And it's either, fleeing, fighting, or freezing. And so most of the rodents will freeze like this, okay? So that's their unconditioned response. If you shock a mouse, it'll freeze. And then your conditioned response, what you're trying to link with that, is the conditioned response. So they have a tone or a light that occurs when that shock is administered. And then after a while, those two get joined. So then when you just have the tone, the mouse has the unconditioned response expressed, the fear. Okay? So that's how classical conditioning works, and it's been shown over and over in various experiments. The other type of conditioning is put forth by B.F. Skinner. Maybe you guys remember these from your psychology lessons, classes. Skinner describes this as a normal behavior that would occur, and then you're either trying to extinguish that behavior or dissuade someone or the mouse from that behavior or promote the behavior. So if every time Dave came in and sat down up front, he gets whapped, then probably by the end of the retreat, he would be sitting in the back. On the other hand, if, he gets some extra horseback rides or whatever the prize is, he's going to start making sure he keeps everybody else away, and he's going to be sitting up front. So that's the idea of operant conditioning. In other words, it's rewarding or punishing a behavior that you don't want. So you reward the behavior you do want, you punish the behavior you don't want. It's the carrot and the stick scenario. That's operant conditioning, okay? What's interesting is that that format of fear training is, or classical conditioning is all based on the fear concept. So, Mark, when you were talking about fear, and then Ed, you picked that up. I don't know how, God connects all that together. And I'm sitting there, I can't stand it in my seat. I'm so excited to talk to you about fear because that's such a common connection that we all have, and it's the prevalent emotion that's used in these studies. The reason it's used is because in the animal model, you can see them express that fear. Okay, we're going to test for joy. You can't see joy in a mouse, but you can see fear when they freeze. So that's how this works. And so in this particular study, what they're showing is that, can you see this? Is it too small? It's okay. So This study was based on clinical extinction. In other words, you make the connection between the tone and the fear, the shock, and then how do you extinguish that? And so typically what's done is you get the tone and you get the shock for a day. And then you spend a day getting just the tone but no shock. So that tends to extinguish. And this is testing for retrieval. So once they expose the animal to repeated tones without the shock, the connection, there's a disconnect between the unconditioned response and the conditioned response. So the tone sounds, animal's not afraid, nothing happens, you know. But what they find is that there can be spontaneous recovery of after time. So even after 21 days, it's possible that there can be recovery of that fear response spontaneously. There are other things that if you that can occur that then reinstate that, that aren't necessarily where it's conditioned again, so that the animal is it goes through the extinction process, but then there's something outside where there's a flash of light, and then that produces the fear response. And then there's the one where the, there's an external, they call it external disinhibition, which means that there's a different stimulus. So instead of a shock, there is a flash of light, and that brings it back. And then the other one is a renewal that is a context shift. So they put the mouse in a different cage or different environment. That stress tends to make it come back. So I tell you all that because there are a lot of things related to how we store a memory that are in connection with it, okay? And so what they find with these different stressors that they put on the animals, including some mild chronic stimulus, and they might immobilize them, they may make them do a forced swim, they elevate a platform, different things that will stress the animals, even glucocorticoids, restraints. So when they train them, the ones that have the stress response, what it shows is that the ones that have been stressed here in the red, they have a higher retrieval after extinction. So your stresses, the things that stress your life, can cause a greater retrieval of the fear response. Now, I said you, so I've just made you all mice, which is not correct. I should say with the science and not make a connection, but you get the idea. In fact, there are various genes that are shown to be involved in this type of stress retrieval. And this reflects in some of the papers, comes back with post-traumatic stress syndrome. And some of the factors that occur in a person's life can make them more prone to PTSD. The other thing is that when the stressors occur or when the classical conditioning occurs at the age of the mouse can affect how readily the extinction goes away. In other words, the retrieval of the fear. And so what they find is that if they condition the mouse before weaning, after weaning, most of the times the mouse will return the yellow here back to a normal extinction pattern. But if the adolescent the infant mouse after weaning is stressed, that there's a greater influence of retrieval of the fear. So, in other words, those elements that affect around us in our life, here I'm making us mice again, can affect those elements of fear. Now, one of the things that we have that a mouse doesn't have is a significant larger prefrontal cortex. And in fact, I was looking at this because this is part of the article, this image. I think I'm going, is that a mouse's brain or is that a human brain? And I think it's the mouse's brain because of the size of the cerebellum here. But anyway, the point is that there are three areas we talked about. Remember, the hippocampus and the amygdala are part of the emotional connections. There's also an element of the prefrontal cortex. And the prefrontal cortex controls sort of that inhibition of that habit formation, okay? And so what they find is that in the amygdala, the dendrites in this stressful situation become a greater number, more, okay? Particularly in portions of the bilateral hippocampus. And then bilateral amygdala. And then in the hippocampus, there's dendritic atrophy. And then in the prefrontal cortex, there's also atrophy. And so, in other words, there's places within the brain that these things are actually occurring. So there's physical changes that take place relative to fear conditioning. Okay? I hated this image, so I've now forgotten why. Now I know why I hated it, because basically it's saying that there are certain chemicals that are associated with this, and we talked about glutamine and gamma-aminobutyric acid are measured in these relative changes. It also affects the gating. So here you see glutamate affecting a change, which is it's an activator, not an inhibitor, and so it opens this channel, which then leads to more changes within the genetic makeup. Okay, and changes in the synaptic cleft occur as this memory is created. So what does that mean is that your brain is involved in this fear training because it affects us. These same ideas actually do occur in us. And so in some of the human studies, there are things that can be conditioned, even to the point of withdrawing if you get a stimulus. And so what we're showing here is that there are ways, however, to inhibit those conditioned fear response. And that also takes place in the amygdala. And so this is, for those of you who are wondering exactly where is the amygdala, you see the gray matter out here on the cerebral cortex. You can see part of the thalamus here, and the amygdala actually scrolls around, and it's kind of an almond-shaped portion of the base of the brain. And so there's right and left connections through there. In this particular study, what they did was affect fear training in the animals and label these transmitters. And so they could show that with extinction training that there was actually a change in the transmitter receptors. So there really is effects that take place within all this, both from a formation of extra dendrites to receptors that are present. And that's all great news for those of us who have fear. In fact, we talked about that with certain timing, there can be changes within the dendrites. So here you see that you get a little bump after about 7 days. And then at about 14 days, you start to form a little lollipop. And under 21 days, you get more of a mushroom change shape in the dendrite with repeated training and activity. So this goes back into the habit formation. What's interesting is that there tends to be a permanent virtue and completion of this process at about 63 days. So that's why many of the books on habit talk about this period of about a little over two and a half months becomes significant. This first article here, reinforcement learning with modular spiked timing-dependent synaptic plasticity. This refers to the fact that if you have spiked timing in the neuron, there are changes that are induced in pairing with presynaptic and postsynaptic potentials. And so if there's timing relative to the firing, that can enhance the growth of these physical changes is how I would sum that up for you. The other thing that's kind of going on in some of the research by this paper by Sheena Jocelyn out of Toronto is there's just fundamental goal to try and understand, you know, how memories are encoded and stored in the brain. And so this idea of this ensemble of neurons is called the engram, and we'd mentioned that before. And so here what they're trying to do is they think they're starting to understand where that engram takes place. And so her results show that this these particular neurons in the lateral amygdala of the brain region are important for fear and are specifically involved in particular fear memories. And so they're not ready to call it the engram related to fear, but that's they think they're getting close, and most think that it's actually a set of ensemble of certain neurons in various regions of the brain connecting the memory with the emotion, okay? Engram. So what does that mean? That means that if we are trying to either inculcate a virtue into our lives or we're trying to extinguish a behavior we don't want, a toxic memory or something like that, that we can get an idea of how long that'll take. We also know from learning science there are certain techniques involved in that. In other words, this idea of spiked training that we talked about in one of the articles applies in learning theory. So are any of you familiar with this book called Making It Stick? Yeah? No, it's pretty good because it goes through how you learn. And so everything from, they did a study where they had two different groups, school children. So your assignment is to read the book. You read the book and you're going to get a test.
Could you cite the authors?
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. I was looking up here, but I don't have my reading glasses on. So thank you. It's Peter Brown and Henry Rodinger and Mark McDaniel. Thank you. And I forgot to read the verse that I put with this. Therefore, prepare your minds. That word is actually the same word that's used for gird. Okay. Your minds is dianoia, deep thought. For action, be sober in spirit, fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the former lusts which were yours in your ignorance. So this is, it's phenomenal how, you know, you look at the scriptures and you find that science once again is confirming the things that are written therein. And so with this learning science, the idea in this study was your side's going to read, and this side is going to read, but every page or two, you're going to recite out loud what you read. And you're going to say it out loud, and you're going to summarize that page. And guess which side did better on the test? These guys. So there's certain techniques as far as active retrieval, and then spaced repetition, so how often you go over the material, and then interleafing that with other things, other knowledge. There's also things involved as far as testing, examination, and all those affect this learning, and it lays it out very well. It's more than I'd want to do right now in our group, but it validates what we're talking about. And then the habit curve, maybe you're familiar with this, that basically to form a habit takes about 50 to 60 days. So there's processes along the way where you think, yeah, I'm going to do this every day for the next 2 weeks. Well, that's great, but you're not going to necessarily change that habit. It really is going to take that amount of time to establish that. And that habit strength kind of peaks out at about that. So to get it up to 100%, I don't know. I actually didn't see any other material on that as to how strong a habit is you can get. 50 to 60 days. And I want to talk about what this is not. Okay? So Mesmer developed hypnosis. This was in 1750s. I think even Benjamin Franklin, when he was there before the Revolutionary War visiting France, that he watched Mesmer do some of his hypnosis. It was his goal was for a medical treatment. Another 150 years later, Charcot, he was a French physician also, and he was using hypnosis to treat mania, hysteria. Okay, Freud had gone to study under him and was also trained in hypnosis. Freud abandoned hypnosis and developed the free association of psychoanalysis. And what they were trying to do was get into the subconscious. And the idea was that there are thoughts that are buried that you don't even know about when you were bitten by a dog, when you were 2 years old, and you've blocked that memory, and that memory of dogs is now affecting you from eating hot dogs at the ballpark because it has dogs. Okay, and of course your father had something to do with this because you're in love with your mother. So, you know, just bizarre things. As an aside, I'll say Freud had a German surgeon. I think he was in Berlin. He was an ENT surgeon. And he was working with Freud on some of this. And his idea was that there was a connection between the genitals and the nose. So he would theorize as far as treating the nose would actually help with some issues. And there was a woman that they both were treating together who had trouble. She was manic, but she had a breathing problem. So Freud sent her to Berlin to get the nasal surgery. Again, this is in the early 1900s. The surgery was kind of botched. The woman continued to have trouble breathing. Her nose collapsed. She continued to have menses in a terrible way. And so Freud talked to his friend, and his friend says, oh, yeah, because she's fabricating in her mind that she's having nosebleeds, and that's so she's expressing this through the menses. So there were just these crazy things that they were saying. So it's not those things. That's not what we're talking about in this process in dealing with our memory. So yeah, are there subconscious things? Absolutely. And they come up, we talked about things that are below the level of consciousness. But we're not trying to go in with this technique and bring up things and create things that do or don't exist that are in the subconscious. We're dealing with those things as far as how do we instill the character of Christ in our life. Does that make sense? So I just want to be cautious about, you know, what are we doing here from that side of some crazy science stuff that comes through. There's some real science involved in it, but also there's some weird things that have been used. The other is that Eastern religion. So we're not talking about Buddhism with the meditation. This is the Maharishi Meshi Yogi, and he developed transcendental meditation, but it's really Indian meditation techniques. You're assigned a mantra in your training, and you use that mantra. It's just for you, but some people who have been involved in it say, no, you get the yogi who is your instructor has about 10 mantras, and he passes them out to different people. You're never to tell anybody your mantra, and so there's this side of it that's kind of strange. We're not talking about that, and I haven't read much about it beyond those things. The other is we're not just talking about tricking your mind with an idea of, you know, positive thinking. When I was in Fellowship of Christian Athletes in high school, Norman Vincent Peale was a big proponent of some of this. Others that have followed on this idea, again, tying in with the psycho-cybernetics we talked about, that if you can think it, you can make it occur in your life. So you just have to visualize that sailboat, keep visualizing that sailboat every day, and the reality will happen that you are now a captain of a sailboat. So there's some crazy stuff that goes on, you know, and then some of these training centers, they you know, really do have you walk across coals. You still get burned, but okay. You get the idea. So we're not talking about that, although I am a proponent of visualization. Just as in athletics, you're visualizing, you know, that move, that triple lux. Those things are important, and your mind does work that way. So it's a little bit of a part of it, but you have to be cautious, and that's what I'm talking about here. And the other one is the mindfulness movement. And you, again, that ties in with some of the stuff that's going on in business. Maybe you've seen a lot of business people going to these different seminars to be able to visualize their own success. And that's not what I'm talking about. And then Ron Hubbard, what did he start?
Scientology.
He actually used the term engram to describe certain things, but it was a skewed element of it, and it's not really science. It's, I don't know if it's really religion either. It's kind of like grape nuts. You know, they're not grapes and they're not nuts, but you can sell it. So my caution is, you know, these two guys come up, hey, that sign makes me stop and think. Okay, yeah, you should stop and think. And we're not talking about snake oil here. This is a radiothorian, but it's got triple distilled water with it, so it's probably good for you. So just, you know, use some common sense as we approach this. So let me just review again those five steps and how that ties back in. Jim, when do I need to be done? Now?
10 minutes from now.
Okay, watch this. Okay, so you remember the five steps. And I just want to take you to this one you can't see very well, but basically what I've tried to do is create whatever it is that I'm trying to distinguish. There's a side of a virtue that is I'm trying to instill, and then there's a toxic thought that I'm trying to get away. So this idea, as I was drawing it and thinking about it, was, you know, I'm going to shield away, I'm going to block away that toxic thought, and you're not going to feed it. It's whatever dog you feed is the one that lives. And so if you're feeding the toxic dog, then that's the one that's going to succeed. But the virtuous dog is the one that you can grow. And so this idea of using my mind to do that through different methods, which I come down to as far as what are the things that are going to kill it, kill the dog, and have the other one live. So therefore, we also have as our ambition, whether home or absent, to be pleasing to him. We are destroying speculations and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we are taking every thought captive. So that whole emotional memory complex, that attitude, you can shape and control with conscious thought and without a mantra, and begin to shape your mind to take on the character of Christ, to deal with fears. The one thing that we have that the little bitty mouse has is a significant prefrontal cortex, which is the area of reasoning. And we can use that to extinguish those things. And just as we talked about Peter recognizing, what did Jesus say? It is I. And so we can remember who Jesus is as we approach those moments of fear. When Jesus was going to heal Jairus' daughter in Luke 8, the woman who had been hemorrhaging for 12 years comes and touches him. He says, "Who touched me?" Jesus turns and heals the woman. At that moment, friends come from Jairus' house, and what do they say? "Don't trouble the teacher anymore. Your daughter has died." And Jesus turns to him and he says, "Do not be afraid, only believe. Do not be afraid, only believe. Me phobu monon pistue." So, and that's a command. So as this whole element of fear and the things in our life, we can deal with through faith in the one who created our mind. Roosevelt said, "Small minds discuss people, average minds discuss events, and great minds discuss ideas." But I have to add that the spiritual mind has the ambition to be pleasing to the Lord. I want to shift gears here and go to the other second part of the topic, and that is the directed mind. So why does that look the same? Okay. And then I'm going to Is that the climber that went up El Capitan? Yes. Yeah, it was amazing. Yeah. Yeah, I don't remember that the movie, did the movie actually key in on his brain?
Yeah, they did a study on his brain.
Yeah. Was he dropped when he was little or?
His wife would say so.
Yeah. She was something. Yeah. Yeah. So the mind of man plans his ways, but the Lord directs his paths. So how does the Lord use our plans, the things that we lay out in our mind, and then begin to direct us? And For an illustration of this, I want to talk about a captain in the United States Army named Daniel Holmes. And he had completed medical school at the University of Missouri. He had done 1 year of internship at Washington University in St. Louis, and then went to into the Army. He was stationed at Fort Carson, and he would come up from there to Camp Hale, where he was the medical officer at Camp Hale. While he was stationed in Fort Carson and coming up to Camp Hale, he had a little girl, and she was born there in 1958. And a year or so later, they moved back to St. Louis, and he finished his internship in internal medicine and moved to Springfield, Missouri. That little girl, as she grew, became kind of spunky. She loved to start snowball fights when no one was looking. She would like to be the first one to throw the snowball. And while growing up, though, her father loved Colorado and decided to come back to Colorado. And in 1967, they came out to Lost Valley Ranch. And they came for many years. I can't find their brand, but I have a picture of Dr. Holmes putting the brand up on the wall. And this little girl developed a love for Colorado. So during the summers, after she was in college, she would come and she began to work at the ranch. And she worked at the ranch for a couple of years. And she also had a dream when, or desire, I'll say it that way, to serve on the hospital ship, the SS Hope, which was a decommissioned ship called the Consolation. It was a hospital ship. The first voyage of the SS Hope was to Vietnam from 60 to 61. As she continued, she became a believer right before high school, was involved in Young Life, and loved camping and all that sort of thing. Very much of an outdoor young lady. And instead of going to Vanderbilt, where she was accepted, or they didn't have enough money, so she ended up at the University of Missouri as a Missouri Tiger. She enrolled in biology and was pre-medicine and nursing. And she ended up graduating as an outstanding. She was the number one senior in her class, and graduated with honors from nursing school. But as she headed off to Missouri her freshman year, there was a guy that came up to her who also knew about Young Life. She was wearing a green T-shirt. She was standing in the girls' dorm lunch line with a bunch of other girls. And this knucklehead comes up to her and says, "Oh, Young Life, Springfield, do you know Joe White?" And she did. And the two of us became great friends. And then about halfway through my junior year, my friends were coming up to me and asking if they could take Ginger out on dates. And I realized that my friend was going to be snatched up if I didn't get busy here. So after my first year of dental school, after she finished nursing school, we got married. And we shared this dream of medical missions together. At a point in my training towards the end, I was selected to go training in Paris in craniofacial surgery. And this young mother of three, we packed up our belongings into five duffel bags and five carry-on, and we headed across the ocean, not speaking French or anything, but we did it. We sold our house, we sold our cars, we sold half our furniture, and used up our savings and borrowed from everybody we could find. And we moved to France. When we came back from France, I still had 1 year of training left, and I said, honey, where do you want to go? She says, well, I want to go back to Colorado. So that first year we were back, there was a former staff long weekend week we could come up. So we came up and just had a great time. And this is my daughter, Anna, and we met a family here called the Ringenbergs. And Johnny there was the same age as my daughter, Anna. So Jim and I, we decided that it was a great idea. Let's put the kids on the back and we'll hike to the top of Sheep's Rock. So we did that together. I don't know why our wives let us do that, but they did. Yeah. So we headed off to Sheep's Rock. I fell coming back and scraped the skin off my left hand, and but it bonded a friendship. And from that friendship, there have been a lot of things that have happened. And a year later, I was invited to go to Costa Rica with a friend of mine to do some medical missions. And then I agreed to do that. When I went on the trip, they didn't have really the supplies necessary. The leader of the trip forgot the instruments. So we had to use some of the instruments that the Costa Rican surgeons had. So we only did a few cases. From there, I went immediately. I didn't even come back to the United States. I went to Bolivia and met a Belgian craniofacial friend of mine who I had met in Europe. He was doing some missions work in Bolivia, so I went there. I was my first year in practice. I wasn't making any money anyway, so why not? And in Bolivia, I was operating, and I ran out of wire to wire the jaws together. And so the local missionary, I asked him to go to anywhere, I didn't care. I just need some wire. So he came back with chicken wire. I guess they don't train missionaries to distinguish between surgical wire and chicken wire, Tim. But anyway, so we sterilized it. I unraveled it, and we used it to wire the teeth together, and the patient did great. But I came away from that realizing, you know, I think I can do this a little bit better. And so the following fall, I was headed back to Bolivia. And these are some of the conditions. You know, it was just the I don't know if it was oxygen or what. It was just a brown tank that they hooked a jar to, which bubbled some anesthetic fluid. But as I was headed back, Jim came to me and he says, here, I take this check. It's $1,000. I want to help you go to back to Bolivia. And I said, no, can't take your money. Ginger and I are going to want to do this ourselves. And he says, you don't understand. If you take this money, then it's like I'm holding the scalpel with you. And I didn't realize what that meant. And so we're not a nonprofit. I didn't have any way to do that. So we contacted Bob Foster here at the ranch. He had a men's newsletter he used to send out called The Challenge. It was his way of sort of funneling money from the ranch into service for missionaries. So Jim and I approached him, and he said, yeah, we can do that for you to get started. And so from there, Jim helped us form Face the Challenge. And so that name in our organization is from that newsletter. Yeah. And so, after 27 years, we've treated 1,280 patients around the world. We've had 180 different team members go with us. We've had 39 missions: Costa Rica, Bolivia, Vietnam, China, Moldova, Siberia, Ukraine. We've brought patients here from all over the world, Kenya, even Pennsylvania. And we've launched two other medical missions groups from that. We've had over $500,000 of medical equipment and supplies donated. We've trained probably close to 200 surgeons now with lectures and demonstration surgeries along the way. We've even had a surgical textbook translated into Vietnamese. The facial deformity, when someone has a deformity, it affects not only them, but it's their whole family. And in some countries, it's seen as a curse, something they've done to deserve that deformity. So it can be very devastating. I want to talk a little bit about a special trip, though, because Jim had been going over to China with Ada Chen, and he had met a young girl there named Wen Rong. And Wen Rong was in an orphanage, and she was missing her right ear. And Jim fell in love with her. And he says, will you come to China with a team, and will you help this girl? So the whole reason we went to China was because of this girl. But we took a team, and we did surgeries. This is Wen Rong when we were screening that that day in China. And, you know, I'm not going to show the video. I think for time's sake, I think it'll be better. But here is Jim sitting with her. This is her ear deformity. And so I take a part of a rib, and I carve it, and then it's slid under the skin. This is the normal ear. And it takes about four surgeries to reconstruct the deformed ear. And so here she is on the table. And this is her chest right here. You can see I've marked the ribs. And whenever I do open the chest to pull out a rib, I think of in Genesis where it says, and God caused a deep sleep to fall over the man. And he opened the side of him and took a rib and fashioned and closed the side and then fashioned the rib into a woman and presented her to the man. And I think, yeah, there he is, the first anesthesiologist, the first surgeon doing thoracic surgery, and now he's doing genetic manipulation and cloning and creating the woman. It's, you go, yeah, of course, God can do that. And so, anyway, this just shows the steps of the reconstruction, and here's Jim afterwards. Jim can tell you the long story of how she came, but she was adopted here into Jim's family. And so it's an incredible story. And so Jenna Ringenberg is part of all this. And can you imagine going from an orphanage to having Paul, Eric, Luke, and John as your brothers? Do you think there's any way another guy would ever be able to get close to this girl? It's incredible. And this is a moment that is extraordinary. You didn't know I probably had this picture, did you? And it's all because a little girl had a dream and came here. And so when you... The mind of man plans his ways, but the Lord directs your steps. You don't know the things that you conceive in your mind and you think you're going to do. And God guides you through those, and he creates opportunities and relationships. Be circumspect, because he's doing something in your life. And that's not only just going to affect your life. It's going to affect your family's life. It's going to affect your friend's life. It's going to affect the entire world. The mind of man plans his ways, but the Lord directs his steps. Our mind is part of that relationship that we have with the Lord as he helps us renew it, as he renews it by the Spirit, those two aspects. And then making sure that we, as Ed said, step out of the boat, make our plans, and he'll direct our steps. Thanks, you guys.